homicide, multiplying and public townhousing. Project their minds to sound. Land's led to the slaughter for sacrificial violence. Change out the council. Police bombing at the bird camp. Young friends fulfill the rules of the prophets. Our kings can be cursed with guns, crack holes, and fools. Intoxicated doors with the sickness of violence. Since all these things is jungle concrete.
Wake up, black people, wake up. All I'm not gonna make them oppressed with. Step our neck. Don't you so that they get away and cry in the air. We have to get up, stand up, turn back on the shrewd trend. The most side everlasting.
I just hope. 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 I just hope.
Trying to escape is futile. Who charge? It's time to jungle is too wild. That's why we got more than two styles. To adapt to the situation, too sharp. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungle is specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven's fire from his lips. Burn the same driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. Which is in the Black Belt, and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app, and in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcast of the various programs on Time for an Awakening and interesting articles that you can download, read at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're delving into one of my favorite topics on Time for an Awakening. One of our historians, again, is joining us, author, historian, and primary researcher, Dr. Manu Pim, is joining us in conversation this evening after being back for a couple of months after some primary field research in the Sudan and Nubia. Dr. Ann Penn will discuss traditional socio-political formations of our ancestors. I think this is a timely subject because it comes on heels of some of the topics we've been discussing on Time for Awakening about participating in politics and political formations among areas where we populate and dwell. I think this will be an interesting topic to discuss with Dr. Aunt Pim. And we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm excited for tonight's conversation, exchange, and learning experience with Professor Alan Penn. I think it's, you know, just it's a lot of great things happening in this area. And I'm glad that he's able to help us make it, possibly make it practical and stay within our historical continuity.
You know, this kind of follows along with some of the things we've been discussing for the past couple of months with some of the historians that have come on. The last time we discussed in this particular vein was with Professor Kemet Shockley when he was on from Howard University, and he was talking about his primary research down at the Maroon community in Colombia, and talked about their social and political formations and how it linked right back to the continent and to our culture, and how they've been in that formation now for over 400 years. And it gives our people a template for what we really need to do moving forward, you know, because, you know, our people are kind of in between. They've been involved in this Democratic Republican charade for a while, and it doesn't work for our people because the way this system was set up. So it's a controversy now about what we need to do, and especially what we need to do politically. It's always good to go back and look at the blueprints. Excuse me, look at the blueprints of our ancestors and see what we need to do. Just like the segment that we play before every program. But Dr. Clark says history is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. So we're going to find out what time it is by bringing on Professor Pym. I think he's with us, Brother Richard. Let me reach out to grab him. Professor Pym, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, brother. Glad to be with you all.
great.
Glad to have you back. It's been a while.
Well, you know, it's always great to be back to share some of the insight that can help the community move forward.
Professor Pym, you know, before we get started into the meat of our conversation this evening, I know that you just got back for some primary research that you've been doing in the Sudan and Nubia, where your main project is located. You can kind of touch on that because that's going to be the meat of our topic tonight. But tell our listening audience, Dr. Pym, why did you start looking at some of the ancient formations of our ancestors to look at their political and social formations? What made you kind of focus in on that?
Well, you know, I started my original primary or first-hand research back in 1989. So when I finished at Morgan State University, I was trained in first-hand research methods. But like everybody else, the focus was really to look at the experience of black people in slavery and afterwards. And I decided to not only look at that, but to take the tools and techniques of first-hand research methods and apply it to African civilizations. And when I first went and lived in Europe in 89 and 90 for a year, I was really following the ideas of the great Chancellor Williams, who, as many listeners know, wrote the classic book, The Destruction of Black Civilization. And it wasn't just him writing the book, but as an elder historian, he wrote about his field work in Africa in 26 nations and among 105 different language groups. So I was inspired by the path that Chancellor Williams laid out, because he was actually following the great William Leo Hansberry, who also had did work in Europe first, because you have to go to the colonial institutions where the records are and the artifacts and all of the things that have been stolen and taken to Europe and America and Canada. You have to go to those areas for original study to prepare you for field work. And that's what Chancellor Williams lays out in his book, The Destruction of Black Civilization, in the preview section. So I was inspired by that. And I was also inspired by the work of people like the great Dr. Asa Hilliard. So when I went to Europe in 89, I was looking for evidence, firsthand evidence on African high-level accomplishments and achievements in the world, and that's what drew me to museums, institutes, and libraries in Europe. I went to 11 European countries to do original work and research to prepare me for field work in Africa. And I knew that, you know, as the great researchers and scholars have indicated in the past, we have a great past and a tradition, but we're in the quagmire and the quicksand today because we've lost our way. We've lost our historical memory. It is nothing more important to re-embrace our traditions, and we can't do it through just talking and imagination alone. That's not going to work, but we must have the original understanding and foundation of African traditional culture, and the best way to do that is to go do the original research. So when I started to do field work on the continent, then that's when things became clear about the greatness of the past and how that is what we can use to rebuild our traditions now. And we've done some work, but for the most part, it's been fragmented and only a loose understanding. So many times people have rites of passage programs, and you have elders who are helping to initiate young boys into manhood or young girls into womanhood, but you can't teach what you don't know. So those who have done the initiations and the trainings themselves many times haven't been initiated or trained. They only know part of the African traditional system. So for me, it was to go back to the roots and foundations in the East African region, particularly in the Nile Valley, to do original research. It makes no sense for the historian to simply talk about the past in an abstract fashion, because information without application is useless. So for me, it was to look at the social institutions and the cultural foundation that allowed us to build monuments and cultures and civilizations that still confound the world. So my work has been in the field for several decades now, and I just returned from Sudan and Ethiopia and South Sudan to continue this this ongoing field research.
Professor Mpem, the socio-political formations of our ancestors, and from your writings and from some of the information that you sent me and from other historians that have been on here, always goes back to what we term as rites of passage. I notice in some of your writings, it talks about the grade levels, so to speak, of some of the ancestors that you was researching in Nubian areas, some of the nations that you looked into. Go over a little bit of that for our listening audience, because some of the information that I kind of scanned over talked about the levels that young men needed to get to before they got to be adults and before they start even having family or start having children or get married. They had to reach a certain level before this could happen, and they had to reach other levels before they were even candidates, so to speak, to hold some type of office among the rest of the people. Talk about that from your research.
Well, I appreciate that question, Brother Elliot, because that's certainly the case, that there's different levels or grades of progress in one's life, and this goes back to traditional Africa, and we still have these elements of traditional African social and political systems. Now, some years ago, I wrote an essay on the five major African initiation rites, and I've posted some of this work online. People could probably find it on YouTube or some other locations. But the five major African initiation rites, this pretty much summarizes in a general way. I mean, each system, they're linked. There's commonalities. There's a common foundation in the root. A common root, but there's also some variations. But if we look at the five major African initiation rites, they go from birth to death and beyond. So the first major rite is the rite of birth. This is the first major significant rite that links the young infant that comes into the world and comes into the community. It links them to the community, to the family, and also to their mission. That's why we have the spiritual leaders who do ceremonies and rituals. But the key is to find out what is the objective of that young infant coming into the family and the community, because it's the community's goal and objective to support the life mission, the incarnation objective of that young infant that has joined the community. And that's important, so that everybody in the community has an idea. That's why names are given based on the infant's mission in life or mission in the world. So the rite of birth is absolutely fundamental. And the second rite is the rite of becoming an adult. And this is what many people are familiar with, and they refer to it as a rites of passage from childhood or from adolescence into adulthood. Well, that's where the initiations take place, so all of the childhood things are no longer. Now one has to take on the mission and role of an adult, and that's usually something that takes place at the puberty level. And this is pretty consistent throughout traditional African culture. And after one becomes an adult, or is initiated into adulthood, and these are strenuous processes. It's not something that anybody takes lightly. And this is fundamentally different, by the way, than how people see it in the West. In the West, in the U.S., I mean, it's an outrageous idea of when somebody becomes an adult. It's simply based on if they graduated high school or if they turn 18 or become legal at the age of 21. So they're just simply dealing with age without any fundamental transformation. So this is a fundamental problem, because it's quite superficial that someone turns a certain age and suddenly they're an adult. But that's how the Westerners look at it, because they don't have a culture of systematic initiation and transformation, as is the case in traditional African culture. So the third rite is the rite of marriage, and this is fundamental. So we're not marrying someone simply because of their body measurements or how they look or anything like that. It is not, and it's not just individuals choosing each other out of lust, but these are families and communities coming together based on whether or not that is a respectable family in the community, whether or not they have means to support themselves and have influence. But the main thing is that, does the person come from a good family, from a solid family? And so the marriage ceremonies are quite elaborate. And it involves the families, and sometimes the young people, they barely even know or even see each other, because it's not about visual sight as a foundation for marriage, but it's about linking together of families to create larger, solid, successful families. But marriage is fundamentally an important institution as a third rite. And then there's the rite of becoming an elder. An elder is fundamentally different than simply an older person. These are fundamentally different. There's not much in common other than maybe their age. So a person can be an older person but yet have bad character. A person could be an older person but not live the best values of the community. A person could be an older person and be a thief, a liar, and somebody with outrageously bad character. So this person is never respected as an elder. They're never given the great deference. People will give them some respect as being older, but they never gain the respect of an elder, which is somebody, or who is somebody, who lives the best of the traditional values. An elder is someone who knows the history of the group, who respects the history of the group. In fact, an elder is a living model by which everybody else judges their conduct by, or attempts to follow in that person's footsteps. So an elder is one is highly respected because they represent the best of the tradition. And the fifth rite of initiation is becoming an ancestor. And becoming an ancestor is fundamentally different than simply a dead relative. See, a dead relative is nothing more than an older person who never really earned any respect in life in the community. And when they pass on, very few people care anything about it. Like for us, for example, in the West or here in the U.S., a dead relative might be somebody that passed away and nobody knew about it until 6 months or a year later, because it wasn't really a significant event. But on the other hand, a respected elder who passes on and becomes an ancestor, everybody stops what they're doing to pay the last respects. Everybody is in mourning. Everybody stops to go to that funeral. And many times, because of our busy schedules, there's more than one celebration of the person's life in various communities. But the ancestor is one who is a respected elder who becomes an ancestor, and that's the fifth rite of the African initiation system. And until we learn the whole system in that manner and have rituals and processes to reconstitute that system, we're always going to fall short of what our traditional culture has laid out as a foundation to guide any community.
You know, Professor Ampem, what you're saying kind of rings, it takes my mind back to the conversation that myself and Brother Richard had with Dr. Shockley when he was on. And he talked about the Maroon community that had been established since before, I think it was early 1600s, before the date that they stated that we came to these shores. And their socio-political formation, from what he was stating, is almost mirroring what you're talking about. He talked about how the children are taken from when they're two, I think, Richard, isn't he, what he said, and observed as far as their behaviors, things that the adults would pick up, things of that nature, and how they would be groomed not only for marriage but to take their place in society. So it seems as though that a lot of our people that were forced here by these Europeans still tried to hold vestiges of our culture, but it was difficult, especially in this diaspora that we faced in North America, because I can see that family was of a huge importance to our ancestors. We can see that clearly. But when you have Europeans that take your family, not only rip them apart, but put the children out there in the field to work with adults, seeing adults abused, seeing women beaten and raped, that rips away almost all of your culture. Our people had a difficult time in this hell trying to hold on to anything that was vestiges of our culture as African people. Before I pass the mic to Brother Richard, talk about that from your perspective, how that just almost like obliterated our culture as far as being here with Europeans.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a key point, and it continues.
Okay.
As a matter of fact.
Okay.
Continues. And like anybody who might know about Jomo Kenyatta in Kenya, he wrote Facing Mount Kenya. And Jomo Kenyatta wrote Facing Mount Kenya to tell and inform the British when they came in to Kenya and colonized the area, hey, look, your policies, your systems of education, it's damaging the traditional system of the Kikuyu. And this is negative and destructive in that here's why it's destructive. I thought he probably was a little bit naive to think that the British cared one way or another. They were putting those policies to do just that, to destroy the system. And that's what happens today and has happened historically, definitely here in the U.S., but is also happening in certain governments on the continent right now by passing laws and to destroy traditional systems. So, if you outlaw circumcision, for example, this is a fundamental practice in many cultures where the knowledge is passed on from the elders to the young people. So when that's outlawed, or their marriage system and customs are outlawed, or people are forced to dress a certain way, they have to wear European clothes because they don't want to see Africans free and being able to dress as they like and do as they like in their own villages. So now when they go into towns to make them dress a certain way, to change their names, to give them Christianity, and that's one of the most fundamental things that continues to take place, but it certainly was a tool of domination here in the U.S. For example, every colonizer that came in, whether it was the Spanish, the English, it didn't matter, they brought in and imposed Christianity on everybody and made them change, made them be a part of the mission system. I mean, I'm here in California. The whole mission system was to destroy anybody and everybody that was in the area, including Native Americans, and make them be Christianized and baptized, and their names changed, their ideas changed, their families were split. So this is an ongoing process, but that's what the foundation of the U.S. And Western culture in this entire hemisphere was about. It was about imposing Western culture and destroying the fundamental systems and life ways of not only Africans, but even Native Americans in this particular country and hemisphere. But it also continues as well, like in Sudan and in Ethiopia. Here we have countries in East Africa, in the Nile Valley. The goal is to destroy the Nubian culture and tradition, to make them speak Arabic, not Nubian, to make them to obliterate their entire system by dislocating people from their homelands and destroying their traditions. But it also happens in Ethiopia. So the Morsi and others are struggling for cultural survival as well, because they're being made to change. They're outlawing different traditional practices even now. So you have people who think just like the European colonizers, who have no respect for African traditional culture. They want to modernize the ideas and the practices, the rituals and ceremonies, and make all of that illegal. I was talking to one elder, for example, who's from the Bana people in the southern Ethiopian region, and he, among the other elders, were very excited that I was in the area doing the field research to chronicle and to record and preserve their traditional practices and knowledge, because he said that at the very time that we were visiting this group of elders among the Bana, he said his own son went to the main urban town. He adopted a religion. Clearly, he was talking about Christianity. He adopted a religion, and he said he's fighting his father right now to change and abandon all of the traditions, because the son is now ashamed. He's been taught to be ashamed of the very tradition and foundation that produced him and his entire family. So these traditions of African life ways are in threat and they're in jeopardy. So it was clearly started by European colonizers, but it's even continued now by those in government, whether it's in Ethiopia or the Bashir government in Sudan or even in Egypt, where they want to relegate Nubians and others to a group that's not significant anymore. So this is what has continued now for many generations, and that's why my work is to help to record, preserve, and support these traditions, because they teach us quite a bit about not only what it means to be human, but to create harmonious societies that have worked out a lot of the social problems that we see in the West. And so that's why we're not able to create solutions, because we're trying to follow, as François Hollande said, we cannot follow the pathology of Europe or Euro-America. We must embrace our own tradition. That's where the solutions are. But unless we know what those traditions are, we can only guess and try to create something based on some kind of imagination. But it's not about that. We can look at living traditions that give us great wisdom for organizing harmonious, successful, and very powerful African societies.
Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. Well, first, Professor Ampone, I wanted to thank you for doing the work that you do. When I hear, as Elliot asked you how you got started, and it's important that some kind of way, some kind of ancestral, and I'm projecting this. Spirit asked you to continue the work of Professor Hansberry and Dr. Chancellor Williams in order to be able to continue. Because, as I think you were alluding to, this kind of field work isn't something that's either by American Africans and even maybe Africans in general. You can correct me if I'm wrong. It's something that is not being pursued as much as should be, since it relates to us. So let me ask you that. Is it something that, and I think you already said, but is it something that is a lot of us in the field to collect that work?
Well, I appreciate the question, Brother Richard. There's not many of us really that do the field work. Let's be frank, and it is time for a Black awakening. Most people who go to Africa, and I mean, some people are definitely on the continent for good. They're on the continent to make contributions And but there's also others who simply go to make money. And that's all. That's all it's about. Is to go and lead a tour, to make money on a study tour, and it's nothing more than that. That becomes their monthly or annual income. They have no goals beyond that. So because the African monuments and the African contributions to the world in terms of huge pyramids and temples and tombs and colossal statues and high level art and science, because that astounds people. You got folks who just lead any old kind of tour for people to see that and make their money in their way. So that's fundamentally different. I mean, I have educational tours as well, but it's to teach, train people, to introduce them to primary or first-hand research. On the tour, there's the field work that's difficult, that's tough, because you got places, for example, in Sudan, it's not a tourist country. It's not difficult. It's very difficult to go and to for the average person, because you don't have roads, you don't have concrete to get to some of the monuments. If somebody was going to see the ancient contributions and temples and pyramids, or some of the isolated communities, so it's very difficult. The conditions are just not at a level that most people are going to do very well. And then not only that, but if you don't have a camera crew with you, that means that you're in the field, you're in the trenches for weeks, if not months, with no fanfare, with nobody applauding, with nobody patting you on the back. You're just simply doing the hard work. So there's very few people who are willing to do that, because they're, you know, those that do go, you know, they're more interested in the more surface things, like you know, being the big guru on the tour. And the reason why I say that is because I was in Kemet just this past July, and people in my group were shocked by the fact that, and it was about, and I've rarely taken groups in July, but anyway, we saw about seven different groups from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
in Kemet, and check this out, brothers, the vast majority of the groups and the group members and the group, I call them cult leaders, they never even spoke, not a single word to even acknowledge other Africans. And I had people in my group that were shocked that you would have folks going to Africa for the first time, and then you got other Africans who don't even speak to you, you know, not even to say hi. But this is what was going on, because their whole thing is just to go and learn from their guru or their cult leader, and that's it. It's not really to have a deep cultural experience or to do anything about it, really, in a practical sense. But that's what happens when people are simply going to earn some cash on the side. Now, if anybody that does that, there's a lot of listeners that know this because they've seen it, but there's others who may not know it. But this is one of the problems now, and that you have the great pioneers like Yosef Ben Jokanan or Dr. Ben. He's the one 50 years ago that led people to the Nile Valley. It's the great Dr. Ben that taught us to respect Nubia. It's the great Dr. Ben who made us drink from the mighty waters of the Nile River. So he's the one that opened up Kemet as a place that we need to embrace in the Nile Valley. We need to embrace Nubia. It's him. So then you have, I'm not saying everybody, but there are a number of people today who have not done anything to advance the work of Ben. You have people that use his work as a mattress to lie down on and not a springboard to do new work. So we need more people who are working in the tradition as the earlier pioneers. So I respect a few who are out there, but the fact is that the vast majority, brother, are not doing any work to advance the cause of Dr. Ben and many other pioneers. They just are simply regurgitating old stuff that now becomes very old because it's decades old and now generations old. The world changes. Ideas change. Research change. Interpretations change. So we must have more people doing more field work, and if so, we'll have more understanding, because that's what the work's about. It's not just going to talk to somebody, but it's about to gain insight from elders, from people who know, from chiefs, from kings, and from observing powerful rituals, powerful ceremonies that gives us insight about not only the current practices, but those practices and those interviews and that information that we receive from chiefs, from kings, from elders, from people who know. It gives us a window into the past. Nobody can explain many things that happened in classical Africa, whether we're looking at ancient Kush, ancient Nubia, or ancient Kemet, because these civilizations go back many millennia or many thousands of years, but we can read the Middle Nature text. We can look at the images on temple walls and tombs. We can study the artifacts. But when we look at living cultures today, if we know the past, it gives us even more insight about the current practices and what their real deep meaning is. Because if you ask elders and chiefs today, most times if you ask questions about the purpose of a name or a ceremony or a symbol or an emblem, I would say probably for half the time, if you don't go deep, they will tell you it's just tradition. And they'll leave it at that. Okay, I understand it's tradition. However, why did you choose this particular emblem? And then you have to dig deep and really delve into it. And so it takes time. It takes energy. It takes effort. And you must be willing to be away from the camera and the microphone for months at a time, if not longer, if you're really going to do the serious research. But we don't have enough people who are dedicated enough. And nobody can ever tell me, well, we don't have the money or no, we have much opportunity because people are going to the continent all the time. We just don't have more people or enough people doing the practical work of turning the experience and the information into fundamental practices that can help us improve today. And that's what we need.
And, you know, and I appreciate you saying that because that's one of the things that we, you know, I was an active member in ASCAP for a time. And that was one of the things I walked away with out of the experience is that we do need more people who we are funding. And again, I want to praise you because your early work, and I take it to work now, is primarily self-funded. And, you know, that's where, you know, the commitment of men like yourself, men and women who are out there, no matter how sparse they are, is so critical to our experience. But let me ask you this, as a historian, as you say, and I want to get to the social formation, but for some reason, I wanted to ask the question from the historical perspective about the value system, because it seems that the value system sets up social organization. So let me ask that as a specific question. Is that true, as you see it, is that the value system reinforces the social organization?
Yeah, absolutely. The value system, it informs everything. It informs all practices, ideas. It enforces and informs everything that about all of the cultures. So for them, the group is more important than the individual. That's a fundamental principle that has not changed. Also, it is about having a balanced life, this kind of idea, so people are not running around looking to hoard material things. You don't see it. This is why they're unconcerned about this, unless one goes to the town or goes to the city or goes to get so-called educated. Now they're getting other ideas, other views, other values by foreigners who are telling them that, you know what, your groups or your village's practices, your tribe's practices really are problematic. They're primitive, and we need to update them to the 21st century. But outside of those kind of outside influences, the value systems in place clearly indicate and direct every institution. You know, like I was among the Kansu, for example, in Ethiopia, and the elder that I was talking to last month, January, he was telling me that among the Kansu, their legal system operates, and it's not a written legal system. It's a system that everybody knows. It's a part of their fundamental value system that influences every institution. But he said that the greatest crime among the Kansu is not murder. He said the greatest crime among them is the violation of a female.
Mm.
He said that's the greatest crime. And he said that when the elder was telling me when he was young, he vividly remembers a man being buried alive because of him assaulting a woman. And then he also indicated that, you know, when women among the Kansu, that's with a K, when they become grandmothers, then they're as close to the Creator as you can be. So there's no more sex for them, no more intercourse, because their rank is too high. Their rank is too respected. And that they are considered queens in the community. And so if you look at that, then everything that takes place in their practices, in their social construct and institutions is centered around the fact that the women have this kind of high status, as well as the their whole system of initiation becomes central to the way they view things in the culture. So this is like, I give you one quick example. I was walking around one of the villages, and I left my, I left my camera in the village, and of course there's no issue. There's no issue whatsoever. Not only would not anybody take the camera, they wouldn't even touch the camera, even though the young people, there's a lot of curiosity because there's a visitor in the community talking with elders, and you know, I had the colleagues with me as well. So there's curiosity about, you know, a visitor, a brother from another location with them. But in terms of my equipment, obviously, with any young people anywhere in the world, you know, equipment is equipment. You know, it's interesting. But guess what? Not only would no one even take it, but they wouldn't even touch my camera. So for them, the value systems are very different. They're quite different than what we might experience here. And so, yeah, the value systems, putting the group above the individual and having a fundamental respect for order and tradition, it informs everything they do. And that's what peaceful about these places. This is why no one's concerned about security among their among people in their villages, because there's no thought that someone would step outside of culture and tradition and steal something. I mean, this is no one's perfect. So if you have something like that occurs, there's severe punishment that would take place. And so there's always a council that makes sure that the traditions are upheld. And if someone doesn't respect what the council comes up with, then they're excommunicated from the community. They have no status whatsoever. And there's nothing worse than to be presented as a so-called persona non grata. You don't exist. You have no traditional rights anymore. You can stay in the community, but nobody recognizes your status as a individual in the community anymore. So there's ways to keep people in check, but it's all based on their traditional views and values.
And Ellie, again, if I can, I'd like to ask Professor him a couple, one more question, if it's no problem.
With that.
And I recognize that you'd have went through all the European museums and collected that data, and you are our walking genie, your griot in relationship to, even though you're doing methodological field work. When we look at Nubia, the question I'm having is a question about time in this, placing the context of values and our social and these social relations that you are observing. How far back should we look at the development of these social organizations when we look at ancient Kemet as having these monuments, but and Nubia having these monuments that you said we have? How far back in time are we talking about a continuity of these social orders?
It's a good question. The challenge is that there's been a great disruption because the area was colonized by foreigners. You know, the British, the Turks, the French, Italians, a number of Europeans have been in the area. So there's been a discontinuum of some of the practices from the old traditions, but also there's some that still survive. And that which survives, you don't really find it in the large urban areas. You find these ongoing traditions, even with the slight variations from the ancient past. You still have these traditions that are continue, but it requires that a person goes to rural, isolated areas that are difficult to get to, or villages that haven't been too influenced from outside factors and forces. So there are definitely some traditions that continue that requires us to go to the areas to learn about it. But one of the things specifically about Nubia and what the concern continues to be is that with the building of the Aswan High Dam in 1970, there were dams before that going back to 1902, but the High Dam finished in 1970, that created the largest man-made lake in the world. So Lake Nasser, the Egyptians call it but the Nubians call it Lake Nubia. So this is a huge lake, hundreds of miles long lake that flooded 39 Nubian villages and dislocated at least 120,000 Nubians and scattered them in different places in Egypt and Sudan. So with the scattering of Nubian people and the submerging of their villages and the destruction of the artifacts, we have now people who are losing more and more of the Nubian tradition, the Nubian ways and Nubian ideas, which are contained in the language. You know, every culture continues its views, its values, its traditions through practices that are encoded in the language. So the Nubian people are struggling because the Egyptian government or the current Sudanese government, they don't recognize the Nubian language as an official language. So it's very difficult to continue traditions when people have been separated from their family members who are in the same village or adjacent villages. And it's difficult when the language now is being lost by younger generations. And then many Nubians are now living in other parts of the world, other countries, because they've had to flee some of these political problems. But you can find people who have remnants, who have some understanding of some of the old systems. But in terms of the unimpeded systems that go back to antiquity, it's hard to find that. But you can definitely find enough that can give us a clear connection to the past. But it's not easy to do because of these disruptions by foreigners as well as current dams. Not only the Aswan High Dam, but there's also the Merowe Dam in Sudan and a series of other dams that are being planned. And it's not only in Sudan, but, you know, you have dams in Ethiopia as well. And the large dams are supposedly to create hydroelectricity, but it doesn't help the local people. It puts them in a worse position. And the World Commission on Dams in the year 2000, when that international body came together, made it very clear that by and large, large dams, they do more to harm the local communities than to help them. And anybody that looks at the conditions today of Nubians and other groups, there's no possible way that somebody can accurately and honestly say that they're better off because of the dams. They're worse off, and they're still in the same low position compared to other people in Egypt, for example, than before the dam. So the traditions are there, but they don't continue as they did before the people were broken up and scattered. So it's clearly about people who don't respect traditional African culture. They don't respect traditional Nubians. So it's hard to put a date on it. Like Chancellor Williams said, I say if we go back to the earliest times, then that would bring us back to ancient Kush, which was centered in the Sudan, a huge civilization complex. But as Chancellor Williams indicated, that is high-level arts and science that goes so far back into the early history of the world, he says that it's beyond the reach of man. Mm. The further we go back, it seems that the cultures were ready-made. We don't see any period of evolutionary development at all. We see a ready-made culture and civilization that still requires that we go to the field among the living communities so that we can continue to learn and piece together one of the greatest systems and one of the greatest civilization complexes in the Nile Valley East African region that the world has ever seen. But it requires piecing all of this together because right now we're dealing with remnants and fragments and isolated communities that still practice the old ways to some degree, but it's not a clear line that we can trace back into antiquity because of these social and political forces in the more recent centuries.
Thank you.
Professor Ampem, according to some of the information that you shared with me and some of the other information that I kind of looked up, what I want to do is kind of break this into a couple of different sections, because you talked about the social political formation. First, I want to deal with that social formation before I go into the political formation. Now, from some of your writings, it states here that a lot of the things were broken into grade levels. I think it was 10 grades and 8 years apiece, if I'm not mistaken.
That's probably the Oromo system, where there's 11 age grades that are 8 year cycles.
Okay, now you're familiar. Okay, well, being that you're familiar with that, let me just bear with me on that, because you know where I'm going, or you understand what I'm talking about. Now that lets us know right away, right off the bat, that the system that we live under here, you had to go through 12th grade to graduate. So we can see here that this system that we live under, that some of our people think is the be all and end all, only is developed because they have seen ancient cultures of our people and how they operated. But let me go back to continue the path I was going. According to some of the writings that I seen here, the first five grades constitute children developing into adulthood and through warrior status and learning the ritual of knowledge. But if you wanted to continue into the political realm, then you had to go through the other grades from 6 to 11. Am I right there?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let me, because I want you to break into this to show our people how these formations can help us today. And I'm talking about political formations. I'm not necessarily talking about the social, although we've been hitting both of those. Now, this political formation, and I'm reading this here, it says a person would be the spokesman or elected as a spokesman. You had a ritual head of the group. You had another one that was war leader. You had experts in law. In addition, you had judges that were elected and messengers who were sent to settle disputes among various nationalities and members. Just talk about those levels, and I want you to first talk about the war, because it's stated here that whether you became a man or whether you went and desired some type of political office, you first had to be, it was a prerequisite that you went through the study of war. Look at that now and see how our people are void of that seem like mandatory principle that needed to be there among our ancestors that we're void of now. That principle of learning the art of war. Talk about that, because our people are under attack and some of us don't even realize it. Talk about that important principle that was there among our ancestors that we don't realize that we need now.
Well, yes, you're right, brother. And it's not only war, but it's we're not prepared for practical things in general.
Okay.
You know, people are quite dependent by living in urban areas. They're not independent in anything, really, as a group. So, but the Oromo system, the Gada system, people spell it basically G-A-D-A or G-A-D-double-A. That's particular system, I think, the one you were referencing, where there's 11 different age sets and eight-year cycles.
Okay.
So, and you can tell what age set a person is in based on their hairstyle and their appearance. And this is very common to distinguish people's social status based on their hairstyle, the paint they may use, the clothing, and those things. So war is fundamental because it's a practical practice that one must have. You know, like if you look at southern Ethiopia, for example, I mean, there's dozens and dozens of groups in the special region in the south, the Southern Nations, Nationalities, and Peoples region. And these are indigenous cultures. And many of the people are cattle herders. And they do farm as well. But, you know, cattle move long distances in order to graze. So sometimes, even now, sometimes there are border disputes. Sometimes there are conflict over land rights. And so what you going to do? You must be able and willing to defend the turf and territory of your group, of your clan, of your tribe. So war is very crucial. It's very important. And so they must know that practice, and they must know other practical skills as well, how to live off the land, how to, you know, and knowing the fundamental characteristics of the animals, how to interact with them, what to expect, you know, and these things. So it's war being an essential practice, an essential part of the culture that's about people being practical, being able to survive. This, you know, so you have this as something quite significant to continue the cultural practices, the cultural ideas, and being able to live off of the land and understand the fundamental nature of different plants and animals, as well as other groups as well. So if someone does not know how to interact with the land and other groups that might be harmonious or might be adversarial groups, then there's no way that one is prepared to live effectively and to protect his or her family. So this is fundamental. And what we're dealing with in the West is many people don't have practical skills. They don't have practical skills. They're not even physically able to do very things because of the crazy diet. You know, so black folks suffer from all kind of health ailments, and some might be hereditary, but at the same time, these issues can be addressed. But people don't typically address them because they're quite comfortable in their current role and situation. And so these are problems for us because people live lifestyles that are not very practical. You take away certain things from them, and they're not able to survive. So what I saw by going out in the field and observing these kind of age-grade teachings and trainings and practices at a very young age, I think one of your brothers mentioned it earlier, that young people are always taught. They're always around. There's no ceremony or ritual or any other thing that's significant that young people are not either a part of or right there observing, and so that they learn from a very young age. But it's all about creating a practical society that will be able to maintain the tradition and the culture. Certainly, warfare is a part of it. So for them, you know, it's very natural. I mean, like, I've met a lot of people who've killed folks who they believe crossed over into their land, and you ask them about it, you know, what is the culture markings on your body about? Or people call it scarification. And they'll say, well, he killed, you know, a couple people. And they don't think anything about it. I mean, it doesn't even occur to them. So I'm not advocating going around killing people, but it's just, it happens when people are looking to defend their land and their animals from anybody that might be cattle raiding or something like that. And, you know, and part of the problem, too, brothers, that happens is that you have areas, let's say South Sudan, Ethiopia, Sudan. In that area, you don't have a lot of border security. So you got people that will raid border areas. There's not as much safety and security, so self-defense is fundamental to protecting the resources and the livelihood of each and every community. So warfare is just a practical skill that one must have if they're going to survive and being able and be able to continue to promote and advance their culture.
If I may say, it seems that I'm projecting, and y'all can help me out on this, that when you juxtapose the moment, this now, of our social living in areas like, you know, the Sudan and Nubia, as far as being practical living compared to what we see the development of ancient times in that area, when you mentioned about Kush, is that those practical experience, it seems, says to me that the knowledge production came out of those practical experience, that it wasn't just the doing of it. At some point, it got into, as you said about the study, getting deeper into understanding the why and the what and the where to it, and creating a knowledge base around those practical activities, which was able to produce those civilizations. Does that make sense when we look at it from an ancient African perspective?
Yes, very much so. You know, and it's crucial that, you know, we put everything in historical context and recognize that what we see today is not how things exactly was in the past before foreigners came in to colonize and disrupt the traditions. So we have a lot to know in order to go to those areas that are becoming smaller and smaller, where people are able to practice their traditional cultures unimpeded. But they give us tremendous insight about the early cultures and traditions and how it was we were able to create societies based on sharing and caring. And people weren't concerned about hoarding materials or anything in the West, you know. So it's amazing to really go back to those areas and see the traditions. And, you know, this is the first time this past winter when I was out in the field that I posted a lot of my images on Facebook as I was moving from one community to another. Internet access wasn't great, but the times that I had it, I posted just some images to keep people abreast. And somebody had emailed in and said, you know what, Professor, I know that is very difficult for your work there. I think he posted it while I was in Ethiopia at the time. He said, I know it's very difficult because people don't trust you, and you have to, and they're suspicious because you're from the U.S., and you have to kind of win them over. So I responded and said, I appreciate your input. And then he said he was a part of the airlift of Ethiopians to Israel back in the 80s, I think Operation Moses. Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken. And I said, I appreciate your input, but actually I don't have that problem. Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't represent the U.S. government, and I don't get any money from the government or anybody else like that. So that's number one. So they don't associate me with the U.S., nor do I associate with the U.S. when I'm doing my field work. I said, that's number one. Number two, I don't come like that. Anyway, these people, they've been around enough and long enough to see what's happening. They know that I'm not coming from left field. I'm coming as a brother from another region that's just like them. And they can see that. So they always, and not only that, but I have a guide that knows enough of the local languages and greetings, because people are always respect. You get more respect when you can say hi or what's up, how's everybody in the local languages, because they know that you are attempting to communicate with them in their space and meet them where they are, and you're not coming to impose anything. So, you know, the thing is that once we're able to go into the areas and spend time, you know, we learn quite a lot that cannot be known by just any old body. But, you know, I'm looking at the current practices and the past. So we have the professionally trained historian, the one that knows the tools and techniques of firsthand research. As I've been trained, this is what our task is to really look at current rituals, practices, ceremonies, and ideas, and to do our best to link them to the past, because these traditions didn't just pop out of nowhere. And a lot of these groups, they don't care one thing about one thing or another about another group. They're practicing their own tradition, their own culture. They're marrying within their own group. They don't care about anybody else. And that attitude is important for the field researcher, because they don't care about what somebody else is doing. They're only concerned about themselves, so they respect the fact that they are absolutely bent on keeping their tradition the same from one generation to the next. They're not looking to change or borrow anything from anybody. And this is very important, because this is what allows us to link their practices to the past. And then as we go through the region, the common understanding of different things is pretty extraordinary, that nobody is really going to learn from anybody else or going to learn from them, to sit down and ask them questions. They're practicing their own culture, one group after another, separated by quite some distances, but yet you see a common cultural practice or a common cultural complex, meaning that there's a connection there. And that connection is pretty extraordinary, because it also links us. I can look at practices today that are very similar to thousands of years ago, and yet the people today can't tell you anything about what happened thousands of years ago. They do have oral history that allows them to maybe talk about the last few generations or maybe the last 150 years, but what we see today is pretty extraordinary. And, you know, but the work continues. It not only has to be the ethnological work to go into the communities, the villages, and talk to kings, elders, and others and chiefs, but also going to the archaeological sites, because the archaeological evidence is also a key source of information. And it would be quite extraordinary to be able to link the practices to a much larger regional conception of how things are. They all have a common idea, for example, about the leopard. They all have a common understanding of the ostrich. They all have common understanding of certain plants. And that's not really something that you would necessarily expect, unless there's some larger cultural connection. and family connections before any kind of migrations that have taken place. So the work is just beginning, and my greatest work is still ahead of me because there's a lot that I plan and will publish from just this past winter in the field work. But I'm excited to go back to the areas and continue the work in that vast region. We're talking about areas with that not only the Nubians but other groups in Sudan, like the Nuba, and also group that's in West Sudan. There's also in South Sudan. There's many many groups there to learn from: the Dinka, the Nuer, the Shilluk, you know, the Antioch, and then there's the region in Buganda. The group in Uganda. There's practices that are absolutely similar to all the other groups, including linked to the groups in southern Ethiopia. So what Chancellor Williams did in the 1950s, that work has to be continued because he only, as he said, scratched the surface, because the goal is to continue to look at these practices because they give us a lot of knowledge about organizing society and how people respect their traditions. They have the utmost respect for them, like the hammer. The hammer doesn't care about anybody else. They marry among themselves, the hammer. And you know when you're dealing with, this is Ethiopia, you know when you're dealing with a hammer person because their cultural dress, their cultural styles, the way the women wear their hair. This is fundamentally a hammer tradition. Yeah, there's common practices with other groups, but what we see about the hammer is that they take more pride in it. The women use the red ochre in their hair and butter. And you know a hammer woman for, let's say, a Bana woman, because the hammer, they have more, they embrace their tradition even more. They take more pride in it. They embrace it harder. You know, it's these kind of things that give you the tremendous energy to see the people are absolutely linked to their culture. And they don't give a damn what anybody thinks about it. To hell with you. And they're willing, like the Morrison, they're willing to protect and defend their tradition. So this is what's special to me. And then you meet the informed people who are broad thinking that also know that they've been raised in their tradition, but there might be other ideas as well that links them to a much larger cultural complex.
We're going to take a...
So these are things that inspire me to continue to do the field work.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones because we've got a few callers waiting. You can join the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Professor Manu Pim is with us this evening, author, historian, and primary researcher. We're talking about the social and political formations of our ancestors. And again, you can be involved by dialing 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people are righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that wants justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities. Take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
If we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, of the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're joined in conversation this evening with author, historian, primary researcher, Professor Manu Pim is with us, talking about the socio-political formations of our ancestors. As Dr. Amos Wilson says, in order to take back what's ours, we need to learn the how-ness, and that's what we're taking in tonight from Professor Pim. Professor Pim, you still with us?
Here.
Let's take a couple of these calls. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to 925. 925, what's your name? Where are you calling from? 925, are you there? Let's put them back on hold. Maybe they stepped away. Let's go to 610. 610, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, how you doing? My name is Adewale.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. I'm actually a student of Professor Manu Pim, from Philadelphia. Moved to California, and ever since then, here I am now. And a topic that was talked about, a specific event, because I studied in classical Kemet with Professor Manu Pim this past summer, and he was speaking about it. And he was warning us, letting us know that the division of our people, the yoke of it, is to take the culture, redress it, and sell it back to us. But they cut the legs from the generations under us. So in short, we've seen different groups that look just like us. And I'm one of the students that was about to go embrace them. And Professor Manu said, let's wait and see what happens. We started to talk to them for a while. Once they realized we weren't a part of the cult-like groups, so-called cult groups, they just stopped speaking to us immediately. And I think that's one of the problems that we're seeing. And as far as the unity, as far as learning this information, as was said earlier, I think the major problem is people don't know and it doesn't affect them and they don't care about it, like the Lake Nasser situation.
Brother, you said you're a student of Professor Pim's?
Yes.
I mean, just curious, are you what they consider a millennial?
I don't think so. I was born in 1984.
Okay, I guess that would, I don't know what that, you know what that would be considered, Richard?
It sounds like, I don't know.
Well, the reason I'm asking that, brother, because, you know, I think your perception is spot on. I wasn't involved in the tour, but I think that's one of the reasons why not only we do this program, but we bring historians on like Professor Pim and others that have done the primary research, because these are the things we need to know to get our people out of this situation we're in. We seem to be going around and around like somebody on a merry-go-round. And when you look, you're back in the same spot that you were 10, 15, 20, 50 years ago. It's because we're not learning from the examples of our ancestors. We're trying to base something on what this European is doing and reacting to his every move, which is always negative against us. So I'm glad that you're out there and you're learning from Professor Pim, and you're sharing this information with some of your peers. But I don't want to detract from some of the things you were saying. Go ahead. I just wanted to throw that in.
A few more things I wanted to say. For example, for instance, about the cultural appropriation and the brainwashing of African people throughout the globe, not just on the continent. We were in the Egyptian Cairo Museum, and there were all types of different tour guides, I use that with quotation marks, and they were all Arabs. And what I'm saying is they were telling a bunch of Asian students or visitors or groups, whichever, whatever they were, that were associated with us, they were telling them, they were asking questions, are these Africans? And they were saying, these are Arabs. And they were putting out features on the sculptures, making it appear as if, oh, this is the Arab feature, and this is, you know, all this nonsense. So when I pointed out to the professor, he said, I'm going to explain it when they walk off. When they left, we explained it, and that's why, you know, he told us to the students, he said, well, the problem is when we don't know our history, anyone can sell it to us. So we have to learn that the past to understand the present and the future. It can somewhat predict it, so to speak.
Dr. Anpim? Professor Anpim?
Yeah, well, I appreciate your brother, Brother Wale. Yeah, so he's definitely right on it. He's definitely been on the fast track, you know, since last year. So we look to have the brother with us again. We're going to take a group to Ethiopia as well. But he's right. I mean, most of the people that are going to Kemet and other places, the level of misinformation is extraordinary. It's hard to calculate how much misinformation is being presented. So it's not only in school classrooms or textbooks or phony docudramas on TV being passed off as so-called documentaries, but it's also taking groups to different places in Africa representing the ideas. It's not only in Egypt, but it's in Sudan, same thing. People have all these mainstream ideas that have little to nothing to do with the objective facts. So the more that we have folks like the brother Wale, who is on the fast track to learn, and of course one who learns teaches, then we're going to definitely be better off because he, as you say, brother, he's able to influence his peers, his family, and folks in the community. So that's what our task is to teach and train others like I was taught. I was taught, and I'm able to take the work to the next level. So that's what our task is. It's not just to have information, but what we're going to do about it is more important.
Okay. Brother, thank you for your call. Did you have any other comment or question?
Yeah, I just wanted to say to anyone who's listening, before I went to classical chemical professor Maynou, he was telling different books to prepare themselves. And I think a good book that he's the author of it, actually, it's the book, it's called History 110, Course Reader, History of African Civilization. And I think it's a great book because it's not projected over read. It's not heavy. It's very simplistic the way it's written. And when I was there, I was seeing everything when I came back and read the book. And I said, if I had this book earlier, things would have been a lot easier for myself. So I think it's a good book that people should actually check out and look into his other books as well. So I appreciate all you brothers. Hotep, and I'm going to see you listening.
Thank you for your call, brother. Let's try 925 again, see if they're there. 925, are you with us? Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to 404. 404? 404? Okay, let's put 404 on hold. Let's go to 609. 609.
Yeah, Hotep, this is Quadro from my BB Tumi.
Hey, sir. How you doing?
What's up, brother?
Good. What's going on, brother? What's going on? Professor Anpim, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, brother. How about yourself?
Good, good. I've been listening. I really appreciate the information being put out. We're actually on the BB Tumi. We had the pleasure of having Professor Anpim on the show on the site the other day with our group. And we're actually reading a book related to the topic that you're discussing. By Nana Fukiao, called Mbungi. And the book Mbungi goes into the political and cultural and economic systems of Africa, indigenous Africa, and we're studying that. And we're studying it, like you said, Brother Elliot, to make it a practical thing where we can have solutions that we look back in our ancestors, in our own culture, as Nana Marimba Ani says, our culture is our immune system. So we're actually studying this right now, ongoing, weekly basis, and the purpose is to reach back and to pull those things that our African ancestors. And a lot of times, I know Professor Anthony, we talked about this as well. We use the term traditional, and it kind of gives the idea that it's something that happened in the past. But we're studying from the standpoint that these systems are still live, still vibrant, still a force, and still recognized in our systems of, in Africa. And we're trying to study it and bring it to the forefront as solutions for us wherever we are as African people. So I appreciate the conversation, and I'll continue listening.
Thank you for your contribution, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
Professor Pim, the you know, you talked about and I want to read something to you and get your understanding of it, because you know, when we see these things, I mentioned about the going through from first to 12th grade here, and we see all these systems, and you know, some of our people, being that they don't know the origin of it, they don't know that it comes or is derived from African cultures. This other mantra that they use, a separation of church and state. Let me read this, and I want you to kind of expand on it, because we talked about the political formations as far as the political heads, the war leader, the expert on law, judges, and messengers. But let me read this and get your understanding of it. It says, an important part of the sixth grade was that warfare was a considered requisite. In addition to the Gada Council, the Oromo had spiritual leaders living in their homeland in southern Ethiopia. Although religious leaders were reverent, their focus of pilgrimage, they did not have political power. Their main role was to be a cohesive force among the different nationalities, and one is reported to have advised pilgrims not to cut their hair, but to be righteous and not to recognize any leader who tries to get absolute power and not to fight among themselves. So we see here that it was a separation between the religious leader and the quote-unquote political leader. Talk about that from your primary research.
There's definitely different roles. So the spiritual leader and political leader, they're different. You have chiefs, kings, the traditional political elders. That's different from those that are the spiritual leaders. There's two different, fundamentally two different roles there, and that's the case across the region. And so when people are looking at their descent, you know, their who they trace their lineage to, it's not only familiar, their family, but it's also the social groups that they are linked to as well. So there's a more complicated social system than what people know of here. That's why people get confused here in the West. If somebody says, this is my father, this is my mother, this is my uncle, they don't necessarily mean that they're direct blood ties, but they're talking about the role the person plays in their family or in the village. And so when I, for example, was in the region, people were calling me, you know, they say, your uncle. You know, I went to a village of the Sadama, for example, in the community house area, and there was widespread welcoming, but you know, people saw me as an elder, the other elders, and then others saw me as an uncle. And we had only been there a very short period of time. But among the Oromo, it's a classic example of how there's a much more sophisticated system of governance, where there's always those kind of distinctions. So that the people or the person who is a powerful spiritual figure, yes, is very different than the chief or the king, but we find that in one tradition after another, that you have these kind of separation of powers and influence. And it's not simply one person that has all of those kind of political and spiritual powers. So the Oromo system, the Gada system, this has been studied quite a bit because it's a practicing, ongoing system that still exists even though people are looking to change what's happening in that region. In fact, we had a meeting. I remember we had a meeting set up, and we couldn't really pinpoint a time to meet with the couple of elders because they were going to address a political dispute. It was a border dispute, so all the regional elders came together to resolve this over a period of days. But that role of these political leaders is always fundamentally different than the person that leads the rituals and the ceremonies and has that type of rank and influence in the society. So this is what you see in the Oromo system, which is quite elaborate. But it's not the only system that way. There's others that also separate these kind of powers and functions within the communities.
Now, you were present during this when the elders came together for this border dispute?
I wasn't. No, we okay. weren't present, but we were constantly in touch with one of the chief elders because we were trying to coordinate our schedule to interview with him. And it wasn't clear when their discussions and debates were going to end. So do we sit there all night, not really sure? I said, well, look, let's just tell the elder, because he's focusing on his work, that let's just try it tomorrow. So we weren't there, but we were aware of all of the regional elders who came together to deal with it. And it's interesting, too, their internal communication, because a lot of the information you'll never find you definitely won't find it in social media, you won't find it in the regular news stories, but it's just local information about what's happening in local communities. And nobody publishes it. Not that they're hiding anything. It's just that it's the internal communication systems, word of mouth. You know, and I know a lot of you mentioned millennials and other folks. You know, it's clear that many young people are addicted to gadgets. They think that everything is based on punching on some gadget, and so they're addicted. But I argue and tell them that you all don't know that the greatest form of communication continues to be word of mouth. And it always would be, and you learn that in these regions too, because because people have a network of communication that's pretty extraordinary. So that's what we really face. But it would have been great to have been in the area. And you know what it is that these things obviously are not planned. So it's just you being in the area and networking while you're there to find out what's happening, whether it's a marriage ceremony, whether it's a ritual, whether it's a ceremony, or as we found out, different conflicts taking place where people might block the road. Nobody's going to get through because there's some clan conflict that's going on, but it never makes the news unless it boils into, you know, days and weeks. But yet those things take place on a regular and consistent basis, but the conflict is resolved as elders still have their traditional roles. So you got political roles and definitely spiritual/religious roles.
You know, if I may,
go ahead.
A question comes to my mind is that when you say the Gada system, are they matrilineal systems or patrilineal system taking out Islam and, you know, in the area? It's going what the traditional systems, what would you, social structure, are they matrilineal or patrilineal?
You find both, but the Oromo, which the Oromo that what Brother Elliot was reading, they're patrilineal, and honestly, that's one of the criticisms of the system, that is basically patrilineal, and it doesn't really give much room for participation of the women. So some are definitely patrilineal, but as I was talking about the Kansu, for example, I mean, you have kings that are males, and clearly a lot of the, you know, male leaders, male kings, but if you take a look at the role of women, as I mentioned, the Kansu and the woman, once she becomes a grandmother, has a whole nother status.
Right, that's a...
So you have differences there, but the Oromo is definitely patrilineal.
Go ahead, Richard. You were done?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Professor Ampem, talk about, from your perspective of a field researcher, because you got the experience of looking at it from both sides. We got our people here in the diaspora that after a couple of generations or maybe a couple of hundred years were basically void or stripped of our culture. And when we were given religions, Christianity for one, and when we adopted Islam, that became like our culture, so to speak. Everything was wrapped up in religion. But look at it, or give me the perspective of brothers and sisters on the continent that still had an established culture, but when you had the influx of Christianity and Islam, how did that, explain to me how that affected the established culture, which was different than here, because we didn't have, after a couple of generations of exposed Europeans, we didn't have an established culture. It was basically stripped from us. But talk about it from that other perspective. When you had established cultures and then you had these religious invaders coming in and pushing a philosophy.
It's been devastating. It's been devastating and it's been destructive. If you look at, for example, the Sudan, you look at Arab or anti-African slave traders in Sudan enslaving people from the south. So that went on for some years up until more recent times. And because of the conflict of trying to impose Sharia or Islamic law on the people who are now in South Sudan, well, the listeners should remember or to know that before 2011, South Sudan was still part of Sudan, and the people in South Sudan voted to break away from Sudan so that South Sudan today is the newest country in the world because they voted for independence in 2011. They weren't going to allow the Omar Bashir government to impose Islamic law on them and destroy their traditional systems. So many of them, they practice traditional ideas and cultures, and then others have embraced Christianity. And, you know, there's still an Africanizing of Christianity, but you do see changes as well in South Sudan. But the imposition of Islam, fundamentally destructive. And it's to, so it's happened throughout the region. I mentioned the Nubians earlier. So they want them to learn Arabic, speak Arabic, write Arabic, but to forget about their Nubian language and culture, which is very destructive. And so we find these problems. And then also I mentioned a little bit earlier when I was among the Bana people in Ethiopia, the elder Arumba Delgo, he told me that his son had adopted Christianity and was fighting against them to abandon the culture, that no longer should they practice Bana traditions. And this is a current example right now, but it goes back to the imposition that took place several centuries ago. And it continues. It's about the destruction of the culture. So it's not just about embracing another religion. It's to have that religion be superimposed on traditional African practices and ideas because, you know, it's about embracing these foreign religious concepts and ideas at the expense of traditional African culture. They don't continue side by side in a benign manner. That Christianity and Islam have been very destructive to the traditional cultures, and they don't improve the lives of the people. That's the other thing. People can say what they want. There's no improvement. How are they better off? They're not better off. The people have lost or losing their identity, their culture, their practices, but they're also losing some of their value systems also. You know, when it's not universal, people do hold on to their views of their traditional culture, and a lot of them have the utmost respect for it. Even now, it's just that they don't remember. They don't know the details because they're off in the urban area, in the cities, or they've gone off to school, or they've moved to other countries. But I've noticed that people still have the utmost respect for the culture, just that they don't know or remember the details. But a lot of this came in, and, you know, and clearly Chinua Achebe wrote Things Fall Apart. And he's talking about the reality of really what happened in the West African area of Nigeria when Christianity came in to replace the traditional spiritual and social system with a new religious idea or set of practices that displaced people or separated them from their ongoing practices. And that's what has been a devastating reality that started several centuries ago and continues. And it's interesting to know that I mentioned border conflicts, but it's not just Africans, different groups. You look at Christianity and Islam and Christians and Muslims, they're fighting everywhere. So the Christians will destroy a mosque and the Muslims will burn down a church. And it goes on all the time in that entire region. You know, they love to fight, you know, so and they fight on a consistent and regular basis to impose their ideas on other folks. And in certain places, for example, you're not going to find a Christian church or a mosque. Try to see what happens. People will be beaten thoroughly if they try something like that. So with these kind of narrow ideas that are commonly practiced by many, this is, I didn't say everybody, but there's many who practice these ideas, this is how they believe. And so anybody that goes against them, there's always going to be trouble. But we look at the historical imposition of these religious practices, and by and large, they've been destructive. They've been absolutely destructive. They've been tools of imperialism and colonization, and people have written about this, but you see it today as ongoing destructive factors as people try to maintain their ongoing traditions in the face of foreign religious and political ideas that are contrary to them, not only maintaining their traditions, but being a healthy and whole people.
You know, oh, go ahead, Richard. Go ahead.
Yeah, if I can, because one thing, another thing comes to my mind, we've talked about the political structure of it and the cultural structure of it and the value structure. How, for those that as much holding on as much as they can, how, what is the economic base and, that I want to believe is integrated in these, and the term that gives it isolation is traditional societies as much as they can hold on. What is it? Is it just herding, or is there other things that that ties the economic base, even though it may not support the younger generation? What is that economic base for that social structure?
That's a great question. I'll give you one example. Like Ethiopia, for example, there's the Omo River Valley. And in the Omo Valley, this is where you find the traditional cultures, where I spent my time last month to spend time again in the area of the Omo Valley. This is an isolated area that has not been, people have not been fully displaced or detached from their tradition. The problem is this, in the Omo Valley area in the southern Ethiopia, the government has built a series of dams, the Gebi 1, Gebi 2, Gebi 3, and then the Gebi 4 dam. And these dams, what they've done is they blocked up the Omo River. And so the Omo does not overflow as it did in the past. And that overflowing of the Omo River has been fundamental to their farming systems. So they farm with beans and other kind of beans, sorghum, and other crops that are used in conjunction with, you know, the cattle herding. Of course, they have cows, sheep, goats. So there's meat available, there's milk available, but the farming items, the people now are struggling and suffering because the Omo does not irrigate the crops anymore. And this is one of the most fundamental dangers to the continuing and the surviving of the cultures of the Kara and the Morsi and many groups in that area who are fundamentally dependent on the overflow of the Omo River. This is what has been their economic system. It's been the system they've used to not only grow crops to eat, but also to trade and barter in the local marketplaces. And this is very destructive because it's not just Ethiopia, because the Omo River Valley, where these groups live and depend on the Great River, the Omo flows into Lake Turkana. So now the Lake Turkana is in southern Ethiopia and northern Kenya. So you have traditional groups in Lake Turkana that are also suffering. That's why there's a group out of Kenya called the Friends of Lake Turkana. This is to try to stop the ongoing problem now that the lake levels are dropping because the Omo has been dammed up, and there's other dams that are scheduled. So their whole economic system, the people in Lake Turkana area in Kenya, there's no way they can continue as fishermen when the lake levels have become so low and the fish are gone. So all of these things are happening right now as we speak that are forcing people to make changes to just try to survive economically. To see, their traditional foods and that they farm or fishing, it's very difficult for them to continue with these practices as modern governments are looking at their economic programs to dam up rivers in order to allegedly create electricity, which doesn't even happen, or to turn those farming areas into large-scale agriculture, so agribusiness, like to build large sugar corporations and things like plantations to replace the indigenous crops. So those are things that are happening in the Omo River Valley, leading into Lake Turkana, in the Ethiopian and the Kenyan region. So these are ongoing and continuing problems that the public needs to know about.
Professor Pim, during the Obama administration, and him and his surrogate at the time, Hillary Clinton, when it made news that they were going to certain African countries or speaking to African leaders and telling them in order to receive aid from the U.S., they had to start accepting the homosexuality as a practice or accepting the practice of homosexuality. How is that? See, because, you're there. You're among the people. You see the responses of some of the grassroots people there. How is that being received? What is that? Because, it made me think that when you mentioned that one of the elders had mentioned to you that his son had visited cities and then came back with practices that wasn't traditional. This is how this stuff is being introduced. When we see a news report here and you see that Obama or Hillary Clinton at that time was talking about them accepting this, I don't think that they're doing it like having an African leader sitting in front of them saying, you're going to do this. I think they're introducing it by people, and whether they're paying them or whether they just get them to do it, going into these areas, trying to introduce these lifestyles. Talk about that and the response of the people in reference to some of these things.
Well, yeah, these are different laws being passed to try to protect to protect new practices and new values, so that the people naturally react when they see things that are contrary to the community's interests. So, in traditional Africa and also a large part of black people in the U.S., they don't agree because they look at it from the old traditional value system where it takes both genders, male and female, to produce life, and anything outside of that is death. Because if everybody did that, then obviously the people and the species would die out. And you look at all of the institutions, they are designed to perpetuate and procreate life. And it's not about any practices. No institutions are in place to cause the death or the extinction of the group, so that people naturally respond to things that are outside of that idea and those practices. So what governments are doing, like Ethiopian government, it's to and not just that government, but you have different governments that are, passing laws to try to protect homosexuals and others, so that people be more accepting of these new practices, which are not a part of traditional Africa, and people try to debate this, but yet they don't find any evidence that goes back to traditional Africa. Well, you're not going to find any of the practices that relate to the death of the group. You don't find it. So the thing is to create new laws, and these new laws are regulating practices to try to get people to be more accepting of certain things or to abandon other practices. So like what's common, if a person has resources, then they can marry more than one wife. And this is not something that patriarchs are imposing on anybody. This is the system that women have created, and this is pretty well established and documented, and this is about having a strong family and having lots of children to be able to farm, to be able to take care of the animals and so forth. It's not about some male beast just sleep on everybody. That's a Western concept. That's why you can go to the communities as I did, and you don't even have, you know, women are barely even dressed. Nobody pays attention to it. They're not looked at as sexual objects. It's a completely different value system. So a lot of those practices are being outlawed by different governments. So a lot of the laws that are being passed are to promote new practices and to abolish or make illegal old practices, such as polygamy, for example, and then to allow new practices that have been spread pretty widely from Western views and values. So this is what's happening on a regular basis. And many of the political leaders at the state level of the different countries, they don't have any understanding of traditional African culture, and they don't respect it in many cases. Plus, even if they knew about it, they're not going to really do too much to embrace old traditions if it interferes with their political career. You know, so like Obama's a politician. Anybody could have saw before he even elected president, he was a politician. The man voted when he was a senator of Illinois. He voted more than 120 some odd times. He voted present. He never voted yay. He never voted nay. No, he's not going to do that because he didn't want to piss off either side of his constituency. That's what politicians do. They don't take a stand. And so that's what you find among a lot of African leaders, that they will do whatever is beneficial to their political career. And if there's a movement or a wave moving in one direction, then more often than not, they embrace that new wave. If it is something that will help them to continue with their career, then they certainly are not going to prioritize, in most cases, traditional practices at the expense of alienating a new wave of people to have new ideas and new practices. So this is, you know, some problems that are happening on the continent now that we did not see before colonialism.
Okay. We at 9 o'clock hour. We're going to take a brief break. Richard, how are you situated?
Yeah, I can go home for a little bit.
Okay, we're going to go a little past time. Professor Pimpers, that's all right with you?
Yes, I got about 15 more.
Great. That'll be right on time. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. For the time we have left, you can get involved. We do have one call on hold, and we'll get to them right after the break. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors?
Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And we're joined in conversation this evening by author, historian, and primary researcher, Professor Manu Ampem, is with us in conversation, talking about the social political traditions of our ancestors. And it's been a good conversation this evening with Dr. Ampem, and we're going to go and take a call here. Let's go to 440. Are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Hey, good evening, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Brother Richard. I have just a quick question for your guest, Dr. Ampem. How are you, Dr. Ampem?
I'm just fine, brother. Thank you.
I was always curious about some of the connections between the Nile Valley, maybe like 4,000 years ago, and the Niger Valley, and if there were like any cultural connections between the Nile and the Niger, because you know, as I study history, I hear a lot about the Niger Valley, but I don't know if there was any connections, you know, back and forth, perhaps any kind of cultural continuity between like West Africa and the Nile Valley. If you could explain that for me, I appreciate your work, and I'll take my answer off the line.
Thank you, sir, for your call.
Well, I appreciate the question. The person who's had the most impact with answering that question initially is Sheikh Anta Diop. And so if you read The Cultural Unity of Black Africa by Diop, he definitely addresses that question. Others have as well, but Diop shows that there were migrations from the Nile Valley to West Africa, to the Niger region. And one of the most significant categories of evidence is the linguistic connection, because clearly language is what links groups together. So Diop has shown a genetic connection between the Nile Valley languages and those in the Niger Valley in West Africa. So I would recommend starting with Diop's work, because others have used Diop's model of looking at the genetic linguistic connections between the two regions in order to show that there's clearly has been connections and context, contact and migrations clearly to the west of Africa. And there's nothing that would prevent people from migrating back and forth, you know. So the Sahara, one other thing to look at is Sahara. You have migrations from the Great Sahara region to migrations to the west and to the east. So we know the Sahara is a great desert now, but in the past, before the area dried up, it was a wet pluvial area where there's many groups that were living in the area. We know that because of the abundant rock art that shows the communities there in Algeria, Tunisia, different places, Chad. You find the rock art, which indicates a wet pluvial environment that supported not only communities but animals, plants. And when the area became drier, people migrated in both directions, east and west. So those are areas you can look at, and you'll see. So look up the rock art in the Sahara, and you can see some of the beautiful paintings. And then the work of Sheikh Anta Diop would definitely be a foundational piece that will help you to understand the migration from east to west coast.
Professor Ampem, before we wind things down, let me ask you a question. As a historian that has done primary research for a number of years, if you could implement something that you've, in fact, from your last tour or trip, you dealt with some of these sociopolitical formations, and we discussed some of them this evening, from the ritual heads of the groups to ward leaders to the law experts to judges and to messengers. If you could implement some of these things or one of these things in some of our communities and neighborhoods or even counties or towns where we dwell to change, start changing our behavior, what would be some of the things that you would implement?
We need a system. Well, we need the five African initiation rites for sure. That's very crucial for us. But I would say that to make that happen and work effectively, we need a legitimate council of elders in mm-hmm. each community.
Okay.
And without a council of elders, we don't have a system to direct and correct people. So that's crucial. And right now, people do what they want, when they want, the way they want to do it, and there's no consequences for someone damaging or doing the community in.
Exactly.
There's no consequences for somebody to go out and create great harm against the community, even to kill leaders. Those people need to be dealt with. But we need a council of elders, not just older people. As I said earlier, we need elders, legitimate elders that are chosen from each community to serve on councils, as in the traditional structure. And if we have that in place and people are forced to respect the decision of elders, otherwise there's a social price to pay, then we would be able to make progress if we're able to do that. I remember when, like you play for time for an awakening, you play some of the quotes by none other than Dr. John Henry Clark. Well, Clark didn't play that. If somebody was out of line, he would let them know. And so would Dr. Ben. I saw it in Baltimore in 1988 at an ASCAC conference.
Mm-hmm.
I was there. And they felt.
I seen it in Philadelphia at an ASCAC conference.
Okay. I saw the world in Baltimore, and they challenged national leaders and said, you would not use elders as to rubber stamp your decisions. You would not use us to run your agenda. And they stopped the proceedings and broke out and broke away from the agenda and the schedule to let people know what time it was. But that's what elders do. They don't sit around and participate or endorse something that's out of line or out of pocket or disrespectful. We need legitimate elders as a council in every community. If I could help facilitate that one institution, then I would. And I've done a little bit to help, but I know that that would be one of the most important institutions that we can institute if we're going to be able to solve community problems at a community level.
Wow. Brother Richard, we're getting ready to wind things down. Any last thing you want to say to Professor Ampem?
Well, other than, and I guess you can say that in the end, of how we can be supportive as you continue. And we kind of ask that because we want the listening audience to be supportive in work that you're doing. But I have to say, the question I have that is kind of off maybe from the subject we've been dealing with. I've been hearing a discussion around this Turin papyrus and dealing with age. And I'm really, the ancient classical experience is kind of like my belief system. I mean, I get inspired by it. How do you view that time, the discussion around those who came before the dynasties? Is that something that we should explore? Even though I know it's difficult to, because there's no reference to that. That's in the Turin papyrus.
I'm sorry, Brother Richard, I think I might have missed part of your question.
I was just making reference to the Turin papyrus and the dating of the classical African civilization, going back to Nubia, but there it kind of has pharaohs before the dynasties.
Yes.
And I just wanted to get your, you know, thought on that.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate it. So, so in Kemet, so-called ancient Egypt, there's different king lists. There's the Turin king list, which is in Turin, Italy. They call it the Turin royal canon or king's list. There's one in Saqqara. There's the Abydos list. And people call them the list based on where they reside now or where they were found. But, yeah, the Turin list is important because of the fact that it does list the early kings, the early rulers of Kemet. And but it's been broken since it was taken in more recent times. But it does list those early rulers, and it's one of those historical papyrus or documents that's now been shredded quite a bit, but it clearly lists the early rulers at the beginning of Kemet, before the building of the Great Pyramids and other great monuments. So it's an important list, like there are other lists, and none of the lists are identical. The Turin list, the Saqqara list, the Abydos list, they're a little bit different. Then you have Manetho, the great writer, the priest who actually created the dynastic system, you know, dividing the rulers into ruling families. But Turin list is definitely important because it has an authentic list, an authentic chronology up until the time of like Ramses II in the 19th dynasty. So it seems as though the 19th dynasty, around maybe 3,200 years or so ago, that they were looking back at the past, at the ancestors, to create histories, to create a chronology, to save the information and ideas, because even in the 19th dynasty, they did not have knowledge, in detailed knowledge of the time 1,000 years before them. They couldn't even read the language. So Ka'im Waset, Ramses' son, he indicates that he could not read the earlier language. He says that, even though he's a royal family member, high official, still couldn't read it. So the Turin list is one of those original documents that gives us an authentic list of what they saw in the 19th dynasty that goes back to their ancestors, going back to the early period. So I love that list. And also when we go to Abydos, there's the king's list on the wall where we show Ramses II and his father, Seti I, who are standing there. And the Seti I, the father, is pointing to the young Ramses, and he has a basic gesture, making an important announcement that these are your ancestors, respect them. And there's about 76 ancestors that are listed on the wall. And so we compare that to the Turin list. And many are similar, but not all of the names are on all of the lists. But it is an original record that allows us to create our own chronology based on the original ancient records.
Thank you.
Professor Ampem, listen, I want to thank you for your work, what you do. I'm sorry that it's been so long since we had you on, but it won't be long for the next time you'll be on. So I just want to let you know that. We've been keeping track of what you've been doing. I always appreciate your work. Any of the historians that do primary research is very important, and it gives us a blueprint to what we need to do to get out of the situation that we're facing today. And before we leave, Professor Ampem, give out any contacts, where people can reach you if you want to buy your books, maybe participate in one of your archaeological digs, things of that nature. Anything you want to give, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, brother. Yeah, just what I would share is that people can find my work on social media, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. And the websites would be savenubia.org, and also the website with my name, mainuampim.com. And you can see the ongoing work. We're going to be taking people to Kemet and also a separate group to Ethiopia this summer. So you can reach me at any of those sources. Also, you can email at profmainu@savenubia.org. That's one of the emails. And I have a number of new publications that's going to be published. And Brother Wale mentioned the course reader. Well, we've edited that to make it a book available to the public. So that's going to be available in the next few weeks on the history of African civilization. That'll be just off the press. And we also have DVDs and other things. But all of this is really to support the ongoing work and field research. So we're going to continue to do work out in the field because that's the most important thing so we can have direct knowledge about the African tradition. So that's what the ongoing work is about. So my greatest work is ahead of me over the next couple of years, and so we have a lot more publications and seminars that we're publishing and making available to the public. So those websites, anybody can find me.
Great, great. I'll be in touch, sir. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, brother. Brothers, I appreciate the opportunity to share the ongoing work. I appreciate it.
All right. Peace. Richard, interesting discussion.
Yes.
With the doctor, with Professor Pym. You know, I kind of wanted to get his opinion based on somebody that's out here doing the primary research, if he could implement something to change our paradigm, what would he do? And you heard him say that we need mm-hmm. to establish some type of council of elders in these areas to deal with people that are out of order and to move the community forward. So, you know, hopefully some of the things that we've been discussing and that been discussed on other programs about us changing the political dynamic of these communities, we can see that that's necessary. I mean, what he stated is changing the political dynamic. Let's see what happens. We can just push forward. You know, there's people out there that's trying to do that, trying to implement it, and have implemented it on some levels in their areas. So, you know, the question remains that how many of our people are going to join in, or how many of our people are going to continue with this dog and pony show that we see all the time. You know, this system is coming apart at the seams. We can see it. The political, the economic, they're so definitely there, they're social, is coming apart at the seams. And being that it was established on unrighteousness, it can't last. If anybody believes in, you know, you got a lot of our people that believe in the Bible, believe in an almighty. If that's the case, this system was created in evil. It was birthed in evil, so it can't stand. If that's the case, then we have to do something other than what we see here to move our people in a different direction. So it's kind of up to us what we intend to do.
Definitely.
You know, I meant to read an announcement before we left today. Freedom and Reconstruction League on Saturday, February 23rd, Freedom and Reconstruction League will celebrate Black History Month with guest Ishmael Jimenez, an educator. Ishmael Jimenez is a member of various organizations dedicated to the education and teaching in the Black community. The following organizations, which he's a member of: the Caucus of Working Educators, the Melanated Educators Collective, and the Philadelphia Black History Collaborative. This month, we'll be experiencing a new method of receiving information to encourage your active participation. Brother Ishmael will be doing a workshop on Black history, wherein the meeting attendees will interact with the instructor as he teaches. Bring the family and friends. Children are always welcome to attend. The date is Saturday, February 23rd, time 1 to 4 p.m. The location is Joseph E. Coleman Library, 68 West Shelton Avenue, between Germantown and Green in Philadelphia. Again, the admission is free to the public. Before we leave this evening, I want to let everybody know about the lineup. As always, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshie from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on that afternoon or evening, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening, and then from 8 to 9, Let's Buy Black 365, connect with Sister Nataki and Brother Talib. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. On Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8. On Time for an Awakening, and Time for Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Friday with myself and Brother Richard. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of.